Okay. Question. Yes. Wait. Now that it's second week of class, now onwards, when you ask a question, say your name. Okay? So I know people. And another thing is, I know a couple of you are sitting in. If you're sitting in, send me an email. I have rules about how you get to sit in the class. Okay, so make sure that you do that. That's the thing. Go ahead. Now. I tell you before the class. So, for example, the last time I told you to read something, that's still the thing that you should have read, which is basically the first reading in the reading list, which is vector space ranking. I haven't gotten to it last class. And again, when I change the topic, I'll tell you. You know, so that's the usual way. Good question. Other questions? Okay. So. The blog is alive and well, and people are posting. Who is Yang Kim? Okay. So there was a discussion that was going on about, we'll get to this again in the class today, as to the difference between database retrieval and information retrieval. And you know, there were interesting comments made, lots and lots of interesting comments made. I think the official line I am probably going to take is kind of closer to what Yang Kim said. So you should read it, but we will also talk about it in today's class. But I think this is nice. I mean, people are actually thinking about it. Unlike teaching quantum mechanics, where you can't have a blog, because people who take quantum mechanics probably don't know about quantum mechanics. That's why they take the course. Most of you know probably as much or more than I know about some of the things that we'll be discussing about. And so it would be useful to A, post, and B, follow the discussion list. Okay, so last class we already kind of talked about what is information retrieval, and then we talked about the fact, I don't know whether I showed you this, but so the idea would be that the user's query itself, user has something in her or his head, and they're trying to express this in terms of a query. The best they could come up with is a couple of keywords. Okay? And now there are a bunch of documents in the corpus, and what you're trying to do is trying to please this guy with this cloud in his or her head, using only what they expressed, which is the keywords. Okay, now, and the way you do it, try to do it, is you sort of try to look for, I guess, the similarity between the keyword queries and the document. But we won't jump to that. In fact, one of the things I want to do is, there are many problems that we'll consider here where there are solutions, there are established solutions, but most of them are probably bogus. You know, 20 years from now, those are not the solutions that are likely to be there. So when we start a problem, I suggest that we think sort of from a fresh perspective. If I were solving this problem and I didn't know that this is a solved problem, what would I have done? Okay? And then try to ask your, having done that, it would be useful to see which of those approaches are actually used in the literature. Okay, so now if you're stuck with this kind of a scenario where you have a user who has some information need that they themselves are not particularly sure what it is, or maybe they are sure but they don't know enough English to express it in English, or maybe they can express it in English but you can't read English, you the search engine can't read English, and so you can't exactly know what the query is, and it, you don't get any points just for matching the query with the document. You get points for making the user happy. Okay? Now, the question is, first of all, let's see whether or not this is the normal state of affairs in the real world. And I would argue that unless you've gotten too involved with computers, humans behave this way. I mean, nobody comes to you and tells exactly what it is they want. They'll always have circuitous ways of coming to what it is that they want. And, you know, when you go for shopping, and if there is actually somebody who's trying to help you in, you know, selling something to you, such as used car salesperson, you go to a used car sales lot, you know exactly the car that you're going to buy? No. And you sort of, you know, hang around certain areas, and suddenly out of nowhere, used car salespersons will come. And then they say, oh, so you're sort of interested in green cars with big tires. So let's start showing you more green cars with big tires. And more importantly, if those green cars with big tires are cheap and there's not enough commission in it, let's try to explain to you that what you really are looking for is orange cars with small tires, because I have much better commission on them. Okay? This is what happens in the real world. So it's not surprising that people, it's not just suddenly that only on the web or information retrievals, people don't express their needs. You always try to get by with incomplete specification of queries. It's important to understand that. Now, so you have handled it in past, I mean in your life. So the question would be, how would you find, so really, this is the red herring. You know, if you have access to this, then you don't need this. Because this is a middleman, and the middleman is actually sort of buggy middleman. Okay, there's a hilarious story that I hope I will scan and send you from one of the Woody Allen's writings. The synopsis of that is, it's like a play that he made up. It's a nonsensical play he made up, where somebody comes to Abraham Lincoln, and this guy is actually trying to ask Abraham Lincoln to forgive or show clemency to some his kid who actually sort of deserted from the army during the Civil War and was going to be killed. And so he comes to Abraham Lincoln. This is all made up. Part of it is historically true, but part of it is made up by Woody Allen. So he shows up and you know, he's very intimidated by, you know, Lincoln and his cabinet. And so when Lincoln asks him, what do you have, what question do you have, this guy says, well, I want to know how long should a man's legs be. Okay, and that's the question he asks. And then Lincoln actually makes a great joke, you know, long enough to reach his torso, or something like that, or long enough to reach the ground. And then the rest of this play is about how he goes on to home and tries to explain to his wife how funny he was, and then starts thinking as to how could it be that somebody came all this way to ask this silly question, and then figures out what the real question is. And the real question was actually to show clemency to the son. Okay. Now this is obviously too far from what happens in the information retrieval sort of scenarios, but what you really are looking for is what do they have in their head when they wrote those keywords. Okay, so the question is, can I learn that? I mean, can I find that somehow? How would you go about finding it? Here are some approaches. Okay? Learn it. Learn what it is that people are looking for. Okay? And there are two ways of doing it. One is active learning. So you ask 20 questions. Okay, so you, the user says, this is what I'm looking for. Then you ask them, no, okay, maybe of these, are you looking for this kind of thing or this kind of thing? Okay, this actually, there is a whole area called utility elicitation. Utility elicitation, where you interview people to figure out what it is that they're really interested in looking for. Okay, now this is how you would do if in fact you're trying to, if you're like a real estate agent, for example, and you're trying to sell houses for, you know, the show houses to your client, clients don't know exactly which house they're looking for. Nobody ever comes and says, you know, I want 509, you know, East Solana Drive. That's the house I'm looking for. They actually tell you approximate ideas, and then you are asking them more and more questions to refine what they might be looking for. This is called utility elicitation. Now, asking questions better be done in an intelligent way, otherwise you lose clients. Okay, so if they asked, if they said, so what kind of question, what kind of, let's say this is a real estate scenario, and you ask the guy, you know, what kind of landscape are you looking for? And this guy says, desert landscape. Then you say, so what kind of graph do you want on it? In a St. Augustine or something else? That's a stupid question, right? Because he just told you desert landscape. Okay, so you don't want to ask too many questions. You want to ask the fewest number of questions that makes the user, you know, that makes you get to what it is that the user is looking for. Okay, this is, we play this, the 20 questions game, right? So the 20 questions you ask better be directed based on the partial answers to the first few questions. Okay? So in fact, this is one way you should be looking. And for each of these, you want to ask yourself, why isn't it done in the traditional information retrieval? And one of the interesting answers would be, even if you think it's not being done right now, there are movements to make pretty much each of these ideas come back into vogue. Okay? So it's good to start from here and then get back to them rather than be surprised that, oh, there is something more than, you know, bag of words model for retrieval. Okay, the second idea is, again, learning, passive learning, which is essentially you let the user give a query and you show a bunch of documents. They said, we like this, we don't like this. You get this done like 15, 20 times. Then you have some positive examples. Those are the ones that the user likes. There are negative examples. Those are the ones that the user doesn't like. Each document is an example. I mean, so those, you have features of the document. You know the labels. So you learn it as a classification learning problem. Okay? That's another idea. Of course, you can combine them. Okay? But these are possible ways in which you can go about doing it correctly. The other idea is make up user's mind. Okay? So what if the user doesn't know what the user is looking for? So you just say that, look, that orange car is really you. You know, I mean, this is exactly you written all over it, and you must be buying this orange car. And you sell them. Okay, a lot of people actually go to used car lots not knowing what they're going to buy, and they come out buying something completely different. Okay, so it's not surprising at all. I mean, this is not just a cynical thing. You could actually, sometimes users don't know what they're looking for, so you recommend to them what it is that they should be looking for. Okay, so that's another way. You can do combination of these two. So you kind of let them ask some questions and then steer them towards the things that you really want to sell. Okay, or, you know, show recommendation systems. And I have this, I think some of you will understand this right away, some probably won't. This is a picture of a sari shop. I happen to be, I don't wear saris myself, but my wife does. And let's see if I can. Yeah. So that's the shop. You think it's like a disaster zone. But so when you go, you know, saris are basically the dresses that women wear in India. It's a, people go, I mean, to the sari shop. And it's not you pick up your own saris. There's a guy who is actually trying to sell you saris. And you try to have a conversation with him. In the beginning, before people showed up, everything was on the shelves. You know, it was nice and clean. And then pretty soon they'll start throwing saris, 10,000 saris, you know, in front of you as you're asking questions. You know, they're asking you a couple of questions, they're telling you a couple of things, they're showing you a couple of saris. It's a whole combined thing of, you know, utility elicitation followed by making up your mind. Okay, we do this all the time. And I'm sure, you know, in anywhere, I think the closest, the interactive selling is done, I guess, in United States is probably used car salesperson. You know, everywhere else you just go pick up what you want. But this is the kind of thing that would be involved when you're trying to figure out what people are looking for. So that's another one. So now, these are all good ideas. One more idea is, I'm too lazy to actually do any good ideas. Okay? So I will decide that the entire world is pigeonholable into a particular type of relevance metric. I know what people are really looking for. I'll just assume that I will say what you should be interested in. Not just you, the single person, the entire user population should be interested in. I'll pick a model and say that's the relevance model, and with respect to which I would be doing the search. Now, what do you think traditional information retrieval does? The last one. Okay? So what they do essentially is they say, look, really, I know that what you are really looking for is in your head, and your keyword queries are only a poor indication of what you're looking for, but I will go out of my way to match your query to the document, talk about similarity matrix, distance matrix between your query and the document, acting as if you were sure what your query, that your query really was what you were looking for. And then rank the documents in that order, and then try to change this model over a period of time if I'm doing badly. And that's what information retrieval does. Okay. Now, that's what web search does. That's what most web search engines do, you know. And mostly what they're doing is changing the way similarity is measured. Okay. And but there's a huge, huge leap from trying to guess what people are looking for to say, I'll just take what you gave and then look for similarity between that and the document in multiple different ways. Okay. It's important to keep that in mind, because later on, when we say this fails, it would be failing because you don't expect it to work in general. So you should be surprised that it works. Don't be surprised that it fails too much. Okay. It actually works mostly okay. And when it fails, you shouldn't be surprised, because these are much better methods. And the ways you improve these is slowly to get back and bring in some of these learning, utility illustration. So for example, an idea we'll talk about called relevance feedback does utility illustration. There are ideas such as user profile learning, which do passive learning based on your buying habits and so on, and your clicking habits and so on. Okay, and the entire recommender system, they're trying to sell you things by making up your mind. And oftentimes, unfortunately, they're right. So I wind up buying what they recommend me. Okay, but I wasn't looking for that book. I just said Amazon.com and they showed me these books, so I wound up buying them. Okay, so who is to say whether that's what I was looking for or not? You know, they did get a ka-ching, you know, a lot of money from me, yes.
But even recommender systems like Amazon.com, when they make up the user's mind, they also need to be based on the passive thing where they have that.
Possibly and possibly not. You can pay for placement, right? In fact, there are search engines which actually still do placement. So how do you know? I mean, you know, who is to say what Amazon is really doing? What's interesting is Amazon will make up an explanation. When you ask them, why are you showing me this? They'll make up an explanation. It's like, you know, every day after the stock market closes, there's an explanation as to why the stock market did the way it is. That's bogus explanation. If you knew that's the way a stock market works, how come you are not becoming a billionaire at the beginning of the day? This was all made up afterwards. Okay? So it's true that if they give you, if they're too obvious and they're only trying to sell things that you would not be interested in, you won't take their recommendation seriously. But they can do 80-20, 80% of things that are likely to be interested in based on your previous things, and 20% of the things on which they have a higher commission. And that's a good idea.
That's what the Wired article that you kind of was talking about, when you talked about how customers, by buying other things, and then Amazon steps with basically driving your personality profile.
Exactly.
What you're looking for is people, others who think are like you, bought, and
exactly.
Then just that.
Exactly. Exactly. So I mean, my point is, rather than go from just here, think of world as vector space similarity model, and then be continually surprised, saying, oh my god, this doesn't work, so you have to do this little extra epsilon. This doesn't work, we should do some more extra epsilon. Let's start with blithely admitting that we know we are dumb. We are doing with the simplest model possible. The reason we are doing it is because it's cheap. And see how far you can go with the cheap model, and then try to expand it. Okay? And so keep these in the back of your head, because we will come back to this. Yes. No, not yet. We'll see. We'll see. Partly because of impatient users. Okay, but we'll see it in a minute. Okay, the operative word is popular general search engine. LexisNexis style search engines do. Okay, it depends on the user patience, and it depends on what their expectations are from the search engine. Okay. At the general search level, it's hard to ask questions because people just right away go away. Okay, but then general search is just one piece which has already been solved to some extent. Okay, but the big play would be in terms of topical search engines, where people have more time and they're likely to be more demanding on what it is that they are getting from the search engine. So again, I mentioned this earlier, the current reason why search engines are successful is because you are so surprised that the things work at all. It's totally reduced expectation. So if I think you guys are all going to fail in this course anyway, and you answer at least one question in the midterm, I should be extremely happy, because I had such reduced expectations of you. And more or less, that's what you are expecting from the search engines, and you don't expect to see anything that's totally relevant. And more or less you are happy with what is what's being given. That's why that question zero was in the homework. Okay. Now, one thing that I said was, well, this you do this and see how far you go, and if it's not good, then you improve it. The question is, how do I decide whether I'm right or wrong? Okay. And in particular, in the information retrieval community, how do they actually decide whether an algorithm one for ranking documents, retrieving documents, is better than algorithm two? Clearly, it cannot just be taking the documents and the query, because the query has nothing to do with what's really required. I mean, it only has partially something to do with what is required. So it's interesting to note, so if you are actually trying to compare two database retrieval algorithms, okay, what would you do? You essentially give the same queries to both of them, whichever gives, it's very clear what the correct answer is. If somebody shows you answer, so if you are saying, get me all the cars made by Honda, okay? Soundness is extremely obvious, because when a tuple comes out, it says, make Toyota, then you know it's wrong. Completeness has to be by design, okay? So in fact, you have to, most database algorithms are designed such that, all tuples which are made by Honda are actually returned to you. So given that completeness is by design and soundness, which is actually connected to relevance, is easy to check just by looking at the tuple. So the only thing that's left is who does it faster. Okay, so you don't have major competition on database ranking algorithms. Database retrieval algorithms. You just make a company, make it fast, and that's it. There's no real competition involved. Information retrieval community, on the other hand, is dealing with this more interesting problem. And so their competitions are, so how do they evaluate? So the main evaluation method that they use is this thing called TREC competition. This is text retrieval competition, I believe. And they've been holding it. It's one of the oldest competitions in computer science. They've been holding it every year for some number of years. You can check how long TREC has been held. And what they do is essentially pit multiple search engines, multiple information retrieval engines against each other on the same corpus, on the same benchmark. Now, the question, of course, is how do you make a benchmark? It's clear that a benchmark requires a set of documents, and it requires a set of queries, so that those are the queries that all the guys would be asked to solve. But it also requires, for each query, what are the truly relevant documents? Because this is not known. It's not enough that the query words appear in the document, right? It's not enough that the query words appear in the document. So in fact, the TREC corpus comes with prior relevance judgments, which is pretty painful. Okay, so for each query, they get some humans, to look at this query and all these documents and come up with, and then either mark relevant, non-relevant, or mark relevance in on a scale of 0 to 10, 10 being most relevant and 0 being completely irrelevant. Okay, so now this is the ground truth. Okay, and then everybody else then is measured with respect to that. Now, this should not be surprising, because when we wrote the precision recall curve last time, that's exactly what we assumed. See, when we were looking at this precision recall curve, I sort of told you magically that these blue ones are the relevant ones. How do we know? Because that's what the prior relevance judgment says. Okay? So it's important to know this point, because this is something that you don't have to deal with databases. Okay? So you have gotten some bunch of people to do relevance judgments for you. Now, this also has an important implication if you're trying to do research in this area, because if you, God forbid, have an idea and you want to see whether it is better than somebody else's, then either you have to do user studies, that means get a bunch of friends and make them say, without bribing them, look at yours versus the loser engine and say, which one is more relevant. Or if you don't have that many friends, go do the TREC competition. Now, in fact, obviously TREC, there may be retrieval, general retrieval versus newswire article retrieval could be different. And furthermore, in fact, a scientific article retrieval might be different yet again from general news articles. Okay, so TREK actually has multiple tracks. One, for example, on bioinformatics now, because that's like a big thing now. And so the query would be a scientific query in terms of what the scientist is looking for, and there's a bunch of papers, and you're trying to give the right paper. Okay. Now, having said this, given that you have the prior relevance judgments, in essence, what you can do is, if it does not really matter what technique, whether the technique you used is right or wrong, if you are able to win on the benchmark, then you're good. So this would be benchmark-driven research. And in fact, when somebody says vector space similarity and bag of words model that we'll be talking about today do well, that's because they do well on this particular TREK competition. Okay. Now, it's much harder to see this sort of evaluation on the web search engine. Even though we will symbolically have first this track, the traditional information retrieval, and then shift over to web, clearly the elephant in the room is, how do we use any of these things into web search? Okay. Now, imagine trying to do relevance studies on the web. How do you do relevance studies for web search? When Google says, I'm more relevant than MSN search, and MSN search says, no, really, we are way more relevant than Yahoo or something, who do you trust? And first of all, how do they even measure this? Okay, now one idea could be to see how often do people click on the top results that you show. So they give a query, and you show top 10 results, and then if they seem to be clicking on the top one or two most of the time, then it must be because you're doing it right. Right? Unfortunately not. Because I'll show you a paper in a while, I'll send you a link to a paper where somebody actually tried to do this study. For example, one of the things that you could do is learn user relevance metrics by keeping track of their stare pattern. Even before they click, see which parts of the screen are they looking at. Okay? So you do some lobotomy, not really lobotomy, sort of sensors on the either the person itself or on the computer, which sort of capture your stare patterns to see which part are you looking at. And then use that to figure out what do you think are relevant. Okay? And they were doing this, and this was part of a big study, and one thing they worried at one point of time, being reasonable scientists, is how much of what you're trying to measure is affected by what you're measuring. Okay? So the question is, how many times are people clicking on the first result because Google said this is the first result, rather than because they thought this would be the first result? So what did they do? They essentially did this experiment wherein they transparently intercepted Google's results, okay, and then just shifted the top two. Okay, one became two, two became one. And then saw how many times are people either clicking or staring longingly at the first result. And it turned out that they were staring at the first result all the time, whether it was inverted or not, because they said Google thinks this is important, so it must be important. And this is not surprising at all. I have a completely different story. A guy called Stuart Russell, who wrote the textbook on Intro to AI. Most of you who have taken Intro to AI have seen this. So one time, Stuart Russell wrote a paper. He had no clue what that paper is saying. In a sense, he knew what was in the paper, but he wasn't sure whether it was significant enough or not. Okay? So he submitted to AAAI, which is the National Conference on AI, thinking that smart people in the AAAI reviewing committee will tell him whether it is, important of idea or not. And they looked at the paper, and one of the reviewers essentially said, Stuart is trying to do this. Stuart is a smart guy. He should know what he's talking about. Even though we don't understand it, let him speak. So he actually started the talk by saying, I didn't know what this paper was, whether it's significant or not. I hope AAAI will tell me. But AAAI said, Stuart is writing it, let him speak. This is sort of the same Google effort. Okay. So the point is, learning relevance on the web search and doing it in a non-biased fashion and a non-intrusive fashion is hard. There are ways, for example, the way Google has done it right now, what is it doing? They essentially make you log in. Now, as long as they try to incentivize you to log in so that they can keep track of your past, you know, patterns of clicking and so on. Okay. For the longest time, I avoided it because why would I want Google to know what I'm searching for? So what did they do? They make Google Mail, which I like. So I have to log in for that. And if I search anything, and I use this, you know, tab browsing, you know, like most of you, which is Mozilla. And so in one tab is my Google Mail, and all tabs know who I am. And so when I go to a page, it says, you have come here 7 times today. That's like a Big Brother watching, you know. Right? But they incentivize. So they are actually able to keep track of my search habits. So one day they can tell me when I'm looking for Michael Jordan, they would tell me Michael Jordan, the guy in Berkeley, rather than Michael Jordan, the sports person. But it's an art form. It's like they're trying to get me to hook down, you know. So, but it's not obvious as to how to do relevance judgments on the web. Okay. Yes, sir. What?
StumbleUpon. It's a Firefox plugin. It's not exactly information retrieval. What it is, it's kind of like a random website generator that you get the plugin, you go to a site, and it asks you what kind of material would you like to see websites on. And it's that, you know, philosophy or blah, 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 blah. So you check stuff that interests you, and then there's a little button that you click Stumble, and it pulls a random website related to one of your interest areas. But then there's a button on the top that says either like it or dislike it, and then why.
Yeah. No, but the point is, exactly, no, I'm sorry. If people talk, it's great. You know, I mean, the question, of course, is how do you incentivize people to give reasons as to why they like or not like? There may be, for every guy who actually does this, you obviously seem to like it. There are many, many people who say, why would I bother? You know, so in a sense, making it, I mean, you know, delayed reward isn't exactly something people are looking forward to. Okay, they want right now. I want the answers right now. And so the question is, how do you non-intrusively learn enough about you so that we can show results later? But if people give you this information, and if you actually do active utility elicitation and people give you answers, that's a great way. But it's just not going to work right now. Okay, there is this whole discussion we had about data versus why money of these things are important versus not important for databases. And I think I won't go into it more, other than the fact that it's not really the case that database query processing, people know exactly what they're looking for. Okay, that was the case when databases were accessed by paid professionals, okay, who knew SQL, and they essentially would write a long query and they say that's the one that we're looking for, and they get the answers for it. But now most databases are available on the web. Okay, and so people like you are accessing them. And if you don't know how to, you know, explain what you're looking for to search engines, you're suddenly not going to become smart and express what you're looking for in SQL to database searching, databases. It's the same person. Okay, same sort of scenario. So really, even in databases, the query is just the starting point, and you have to figure out what the user is looking for. And so the queries can be imprecise, and you need to do things like precision recall in databases too. Much of, if you look at SIGMOD papers nowadays, SIGMOD, you know, VLDB papers nowadays, large number of papers do precision recall studies, and it's a database conference. Okay? So only traditional databases where paid professionals use the databases are different enough from information retrieval that you can think just in terms of response time and nothing else matters. Okay. So, okay. Having said all this, let's go through the information retrieval, the basic pieces. So you are trying to do this. You have a bunch of documents. We'll assume that there are prior relevance judgments that somebody has. They won't show it to you. First, you have to show your top-ranked documents, and somebody compares them to the prior relevance judgments and draw the precision recall curves, and whoever wins with respect to the precision recall curve wins the track competition. Okay? Or they can do a measure or something. So now, what would you go about doing? So you get a query and from the user, and you have a bunch of documents, of course, and these documents are indexed, and the most obvious index for the documents is inverted index. All that says is for each word, it tells you what are all the documents where this word occurs and where exact positions in the document this word occurs. That's all it says. Okay, and it's a very useful data structure. We'll look at it a little bit more, you know, later on, but inverted indices are not that hard. It's basically like the index at the end of your book, which tells you for every word in the book. I mean, that will only, the indexes in the end of a textbook tell you some of the important terms and where they appear in the textbook, right, what pages. Now, that's basically what an inverted index does. The one of the questions, of course, is whether you index all the words or you index only some words. In the traditional information retrieval, somebody, the expert for the information retrieval, comes up with a bunch of keywords. And documents are only indexed in terms of the keywords. Not all the words, but the keywords. Okay? But in the web search, in, you know, basically you assume that there is no such expert, so you will index it with respect to every word in the document. So for every word, you know occurrences. Where it does it appear? In what documents does it appear? And what positions in the document does it appear? That's the information you need to be able to, you know, pick the document. Okay. So you have the index, and then so you have the user query that's coming in. And the first thing you do is for the user query in the traditional information retrieval, you can do text operations on the query itself, and also on the database on the document. Okay, the kind of operations you can do are things like stemming. That means if you have multiple forms, I mean, again, much of this discussion, unfortunately, is only English specific because each language has its own interesting characteristics. Many of these text operations depend upon the language. Okay, so in English, verbs have multiple forms, and so you might want to just convert it into the canonical form. You know, if you say walking, walked, all of them become walk, for example. Okay, that's a stemming. Okay, the other thing is noun phrase detection. Some words go together. Computer science, data structures. Okay, so you may want to combine those words into basically a super word rather than two different words. Okay, you can do this, and if you do that, normally what happens is you, after doing that, you index the document. So that if people are looking for computer science as against just computer, then you give them different documents. Computer science means, you know, computer science occurs together, next to each other. It's like a single noun phrase, okay? So you can do this noun phrase detection both in the document and in the query, and you can also do stemming. And furthermore, you can do one other thing is the stop word elimination. So if there are words like the article in English language, you know, remove them. Which to me is fine because I'm from India and I don't understand the whole point of articles. And I just write whatever I want to write and put in a couple of the's and remove a couple of a's, you know, because that's what I think they're using. So I really think they're anyway stop words, so remove the whole bunch of them. And but stop word really could be any word which normally doesn't have any linguistic meaning. Okay? And so you can remove it and things don't change. And in fact, one of the stuff, if everybody in the corpus has this word, then normally you can remove that word because everybody has it. So if you have a bunch of computer science documents, then computer would be a stop word. There's no point indexing computer because everybody is a computer science document, so they all have computer in there. Okay? The reason you are doing all this is twofold. On this side, you're trying to reduce the number of index words. So you can keep the inverted index small. Okay? On this side, you're trying to improve the query quality. Okay, by removing the useless words and standardizing the words such that, you know, walk becomes walk, and if there is a file which says walk and the user was looking for walked, and there is no file which is saying walk. So the user was looking for the word walked, and the only document you have has the word walk, but not walked. So, you know, you would have not retrieved it. Whereas if you stemmed it, then walk will become walk, and then you would be able to retrieve it. Okay? And then after that, you know, one other thing you can do is query operations, improve just the quality of the query by adding or suggesting adding extra keywords to the query. Okay, this is called query elaboration. One of the ideas is, so you said computer, maybe what you're interested in, would you be more specific? Here, you know, these are the words that seem to be co-occurring most of the time. You know, you ask for computers, are you interested in computer hardware, computer software, computer science, computer architecture? Now, it's not that the search engine suddenly understood computer science and computers and it's telling you this. All it did was it did some co-occurrence analysis. It found that the word computer seems to be occurring close by with the word science or the word architecture. And so we will talk about this kind of analysis, co-occurrence analysis, which will then be the most close words to computer would then be given to the user and asked, do you want to click on any of these also to increase the size of the query? Yes?
I was wondering, how do modern search engines like Google handle the trade-off between implementing text operations and stop lists and indexing keywords, but at the same time, then if they don't do full text indexing, you can't search for phrases.
Yeah. So what do they do? Does Google do stemming? No. Does Google do stop word elimination? Barely. Okay. So basically, in fact, one of the interesting things is most search engines, I mean, again, remember this is traditional information retrieval. And when you go to the web search, most web search engines just do full text indexing. Okay. Remember that there were two reasons why you were doing the text operations. One is to improve the indexing efficiency, and the other is to improve the query quality. Okay. Now the indexing efficiency is no longer an issue in the days of, you know, petabyte storage and, you know, large number of clusters of computers. Traditional information retrieval started in those days when, you know, Bill Gates famously said nobody needs more than 640K. Disk space. That's enough. You know, nobody would need more than that. Okay, but now his programs don't even, the first disk of their programs don't even fit. Okay, so we have changed completely. So this justification has gone away, so full text indexing is what really search engines do. But this justification hasn't gone away, so you pay for it. Okay, but then if you are the only search engine that everybody is using and they don't seem to have alternatives, what do? You're happy with whatever they do. Okay. And then finally, you search. That means you get a candidate set of documents which seem to have these keywords. Okay. And that can be done efficiently because you have an access to inverted index. So for each word, you know exactly the documents where this word appears and also exactly the positions in those documents where this word appears. So you can do, you know, intersection operations on these sets to get the set of documents which contain all the keywords. Okay, having done that, the next thing is you have a bunch of documents. The biggest question is they're not all created equal. Just because all of them have the query word, they're not created equal. You need to rank them. Okay, so this is obviously the biggest difference. Up to here, it's just, I mean, this part. And this part and this part is pure computer science, just algorithms. Okay? This and this is what brings information retrieval into the picture. Because here you're trying to add, this and this, they are taking into account, this one is taking into account the language feature. This is sort of taking into account the document corpus's global features. And this is trying to take into account the relevance function that the user implicitly has in their mind, or actually the query that they're looking for. Okay. So mostly the first thing we will focus on is ranking, because that's really the big thing. Now, if you're trying to do a search engine and you don't do these well, you'll never get here. Because you're talking about 1 billion documents or more, God knows, I mean, 8 billion, I guess, now. And if you don't do your inode index well, and if you don't do your retrieval well, then it will take hours to actually just get to the point where you have all the documents, and then you start ranking them, and all the users have left. Okay, so it is important to do this, and we will come back to this later. But the most interesting thing that you have never thought of is ranking part, so we'll look at that first. Okay. Okay, this basically is just a description of how an inverted index looks like. I mean, I don't think that we'll come back to it later, but you know, so you have a word and the number of documents it appears, the total frequency with which it appears in the document, and for each there, you know, so for example here, country is appearing in two documents, and the total number of times it appears in those two documents combined is 2 times, and here in the document 1, it appears 1 time, in the document 2, it appears 1 time, and normally you need to have one more piece of information which tells you in the document 1, it appears 1 time in position 79, okay, and in the document 2, it appears 1 time in position, 2 times, let's say, in position 78 and position 29. Why is position important? Why is it not enough to just say where the word is appearing? Exactly. So suppose, you know, if this happens all the time for you guys, right? So you say computer science, and you might wind up getting, if you go down enough in the ranking, you might wind up getting a page which has computer in one paragraph and science 3 paragraphs later. Now, for computer science itself, at least the top 10 results will have computer science next to each other because there are enough documents of that kind. But if you say crazy words, you know, crazy combinations of words, you know, for which there are not enough documents, then Google will find, I mean, basically a search engine will find any document where those appear. And, you know, if these words are appearing, then one idea you would like to look at is how close are they appearing? Because if the user gave a bunch of words together, then probably they should appear together. Okay, the position is used for proximity search. Okay, taking the proximity into account. In fact, when we are looking at the vector space ranking, we'll actually ignore the proximity for a while. But search engines such as Google do support proximity search. So that if there are multiple documents which are all equal in terms of the keywords being present, the ones which where the keywords are close to each other are shown earlier than the ones which are not. Okay, so now this is the piece that I was telling you earlier. You know, in the IR, normally you kind of generate keywords in by starting from the document and, you know, removing bunch of things such that it becomes just a bunch of keywords. And the first few are easy to do. You can remove the spaces, you can remove the accents, you can remove the stop words, you can remove, and you can group the noun groups. You can do stemming, which is basically of the kind walked becomes walk, walking becomes walk, and then finally, at which point, if you are like a LexisNexis kind of a thing, then a human expert will then say, well, of these words, these are the only ones that you should actually remember. Now, textbook indexes are done this way, right? You know, there are very few textbook indexes which tell you where the word the is present in the textbook, or even where the word the computer is present in the textbook. Okay, they only pick some words that are actually sort of important for the subject matter. Those are the only ones you potentially will be looking for. So somebody did manual indexing. Okay, if you ignore the manual indexing, then you have full search, full text index. Okay. For the stemming, by the way, this there is a guy, even, you know, it's not like this is exactly that hard. Only one guy needs to write a stemmer for the language and everybody else can use it. Okay? So there's this guy called Foster who wrote a stemmer, you know, a program, an algorithm, which basically is language specific. It only makes sense for English. If you try to apply it to any other language, you're dead. You know, and then what it does is mostly does the reasonable thing. And there are, it basically knows when to, you know, cut out. So for example, if you have a word which is ending with an isation and a prefix contains at least one vowel followed by a consonant, then replace the isation with I-Z-E. Turns out it's a good rule. This is sort of the kind of rules which tell you, in which you those of you who went to grade school in English speaking countries would have been told, for example, what's this? I before E except after C, right? You know, which nonsensical rule. It turns out it doesn't work most of the time. My son keeps yelling at me that that rule doesn't work. But it's a rule. You know, it's like you're trying to find some patterns, you know, as to why English spelling makes any sense. And similarly, this is, you know, a rule. These kinds of rules, they're stratified set of rules, and if you apply them, you can stem the text correctly with reasonably good precision. Okay, and so everybody does Porter Stemmer. Anybody who wants to do stemming at all, downloads Porter Stemmer program and applies it. That's it. Okay, I won't even bother teaching you what stemming, you know, what that program does, but basically you understand how that thing works. Okay, so here is a simple example. If you have like either a text document or a query, which is like this, the number of web pages on the World Wide Web was estimated to be over 800 million in 1999. Okay, so you remove the stop word elimination, the, of, on, the, was, to be, over, gone. Okay, and then you remove, you do stemming, estimated becomes estimate. In fact, I already did the wrong stemming, you know, there is no estimate, so you should be removing the D, and I'm sure Mr. Porter would have told me the right way. And then you have the words which can be indexed. If you do manual indexing on top of it, then you can pick some of them. Okay, so for example, web is something that you could have removed as a stop word, because most words, in fact, if you tell Google to search for World Wide Web Conference, which is like the very best conference on the web related research, it has really hard time finding it, because World Wide Web is so common that every page has it, and it even gives you a warning saying, you know, it's hard to find. So the way to find it is, you know, indirectly, you know, knowing where it was held, or say www.10, www.15, something like that, you know. So stop words could be also context dependent. So these are the questions that we sort of already answered. Does Google use stemming? Does it use all kinds of stemming? Does it do stop word elimination? Are there any non-obvious stop words? You can answer all of these. It's like, one of the nice things about computer science is we don't need major equipment to do experiments. You know, you go, you switch on your laptop and search, and then figure out whether, you know, any search engine does this or not. There were some raised hands somewhere. Yes?
I just have a doubt about the stop word elimination.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you decide what are the stop words? Here, I mean, if I want to search for things which are greater than 800 million,
mm-hmm.
and that word is being removed there, over.
I did not remove 800 though.
No, over. If I want something,
yeah,
it's
a good question.
Results,
that's a good question.
If just one, I'm saying that greater than something.
It's a good question. I think, in fact, over should not be removed. But, you know, it's an issue. I mean, basically, that's why, in fact, you'll find that Google does not remove most of the words. Okay. But having said that, nobody in the information retrieval community ever told you that you get to ask questions like, give me documents which talk about over 800 million. Okay? If you want to do that, they'll look at you and say, go do database. Okay? Because there is no structure, text. So all they can tell you is, you know, so if you do, let's say, suppose I did not remove over, but in fact, the sentence was to be not over 800 million. Right? And you look for over 800 million. By God, I'll show you this document, and you don't get to yell at me, because I don't understand English. You know, I'm faking it, and it's like there was this neat idea. I mean, I'll act as if I'm doing useful stuff, and you act as if you are happy. You know, that's what search engines do right now. So we basically show you over 800, and you know, it still doesn't mean you have figured out the meaning.
And the previous slide you showed, there's something called noun phrase.
Yeah.
Whatever. So that comes in here, right? I mean, if I say over, not over 800, you have to kind of figure
but
out what.
Not over 800 is not the noun phrase. You know, if you, the way you are looking at it, you are understanding English.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And you need chacha.com, which we talked about in the beginning of the class, which is human search engine. You know, people actually do this search for you. But, you know, it's a slippery slope, and you really, it's clear that if you understand English or any language at all, you can help people much better. But it's also clear that we have no clue how to do that. Yes.
So it seems to me that if you are not actually trying to mimic NLP, then most of your words, except like most of the words, like for example, in, over, all this stuff here, can go out of the window as stop words.
Yeah.
Because the same thing that you said for over 800 million, again, if you remove in there, you don't know if 1999.
But here is an interesting point, I'll tell you. We keep your eyes open if you know, God willing, and we, before the end of the class, we look at another idea which becomes a more general form of stop word elimination. So that you don't have to do stop word elimination. If you do that idea, it figures out sort of a degree of importance of the word. Okay? I mean, you guys know this is basically inverse document frequency. And if you use inverse document frequency idea, that tells you, you know, what the stop, basically what stop words are. Okay, why don't search engines do much text stops? I already went through this. This is my, you know, yelling at search engines. You can read it again carefully as to why I think they don't. Nobody told me exactly why they don't, but, you know, you should read this. Okay, so the question, of course, is ranking, and you want to do likelihood of relevance. There are all sorts of problems. There is no real reason to expect that by looking at the similarity between the query and the document, you will figure out what is relevant to the user. Okay? So you should take what you get and not complain too much. And I somehow like this poem, which says, "We dance around in the ring and suppose, but the secret sits in the middle and knows." Which is more or less what's happening in the information retrieval, because we do some sort of a dance by comparing, you know, the document to the query, but really all of us know that the query is at best sort of a beginning of the dialogue. Okay? But given that, how do you go about ranking? There are multiple ways, and you know, this is like an information retrieval textbook's view of what the ranking algorithms differ as. And all we will look at actually is just one idea. Basically, vectors think of documents as bags of words and do vector similarity between them. Okay? That's, yes? Yes?
Before we go this much further, I want to ask about the page form ranking that you talked about earlier. Because if we were to have something like pure programming and you have certain words that are associated with, or certain topics are associated with that phrase, then wouldn't you need links between different phrases and everything that was related to that phrase? Wouldn't the story?
So you're talking about when you identify a noun phrase. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Like for example, you put in computer programming,
mm-hmm.
and the search engine is like, "Oh, computer programming," and you open something related to C or Java,
mm-hmm.
something like that. So you have to have relationships.
No. So the relationships, to the extent the search engines know any relationships, that will come from co-occurrence analysis. We'll talk about how words occurring together must have something to do with each other. Okay. But in terms of the reason you even detect noun phrases is so that when the keyword list contains, you know, computer programming book, then really you think of this as one word, word one, and this as word two, and then all the documents also, whenever computer programming occurs together, it is a word called computer programming. Even though it's not an English word, it is a word as far as search engine is concerned. So it's an indivisible entity. Okay.
Also,
yes.
Why can't search engines do
grammatical? No. Okay, and also part of these questions, we should do it in an order, because there's a reason why we are going in this order. I know that everybody wants to know just about the search engine, but let's figure out what information retrieval is doing, and then we'll see what additional things that search engines do. Grammatical analysis is a good thing to do, but most don't do. Okay, and it's again some of the things that are coming back. TextOps is the closest that comes from the information retrieval community, which takes language into account. Okay. Okay, so there are two ideas at least I will look at. Unfortunately, we are running out of time, but let's at least look at these two ideas quickly. One is the Boolean model, which basically thinks of keywords, so thinks of the documents as sets of words. So documents are sets. Now the important thing about a set is either a word is present in the set or not present in the set. There is no such thing as the word is present five times in the set. Okay? So the documents are sets, and in fact, the documents contain all the words they contain, So in fact, you can think of each document. If document D1 has word 1, word 2, word 3, etc., word 10, then really you can think of it as this Boolean expression, W1 and W2 and W3, etc., and W10. So documents are conjunctive propositional formulas, for those of you who know propositional logic. Okay? Now what is a query? A query can be any, a query is any Boolean formula over keyword. Okay? So it can be any Boolean formula over keyword, any propositional formula over keyword. Now the nice thing is, irrespective of the, so in particular, it could include negation of keywords. So I could say, you know, give me all the documents which contain keyword B only when they contain keyword A, and not otherwise. And I can say this, because it's a propositional logic statement, I can write that. And then I can then see whether or not that particular propositional logic statement holds in this document. Okay. Now furthermore, in fact, one of the nice things is documents are closed world. So if the total number of words in the world in your corpus is W1 up to W1 million, and this document has W1 to W10, it means it also does not have W11 to W1 million. So it doesn't have, there's no mystery. They're not there, that's it. Okay, so if you're looking for, you know, a document which contains W3 and not W11, this is a friend. You can bring this out. Okay? So Boolean retrieval is essentially directly applying propositional model checking. Okay? In particular, the easiest way to think about it, for those of you who know something about DNF formulation, is this is actually sum of product formulation, for those of you from the CSE 120. And it's also called the disjunctive normal form, for those of you who did 471, which is any propositional logic formula can be written into a canonical form called a DNF form, where a DNF form essentially is a disjunction of clauses, such that each clause is a conjunction of literals, where each literal is either a keyword or the negation of a keyword. So any Boolean formula at all can be written this way. And once you have this, all you are checking is, if I am given this query and I'm trying to see whether a document satisfies this or not, you just need to check whether this, you know, sort of a math checking, are these three present in the document? If not, are these three? If not, are these three? Okay, where zero is not being present. Okay, that's what you do in Boolean retrieval. Okay, it's not particularly hard to do. One nice thing about Boolean retrieval is you can actually do Boolean operations. You can talk about things like, the query is keyword A and either keyword B or not keyword C. So I should have, you know, this word, the first word, and either I have the second word or I have the next, or I don't have the third word. Okay, nice query. Okay, and you can answer those sort of things by just using this sort of a model. And it's been used, and even now it is actually used, at least partly, along with the vector similarity model. The problem, of course, one major problem with the Boolean model is that retrieval based on the binary criteria, it does not have a notion of partial match. Suppose I'm looking for three keywords, and I mean, suppose I'm looking for conjunction of 15 keywords. Okay, so all of them should be present, and I have no documents which have all 15 of them present. One has 14, one has 3 present. Now, clearly, you are happy to get the one with the 14 keywords present, but this guy would basically throw all of them as non-answers. Okay, so there's no notion of partial answers. Furthermore, every keyword is equally important. There is no such thing as this keyword is somehow less important than this other keyword. Okay, it's a really Boolean binary decision making. Okay, they are present or not present. Okay, so the other problem, of course, is human users. You know, it's nice that Boolean keyword, Boolean queries are interesting. You know, you get to write all these complex Boolean formulae. But there were stairs right now when I was talking about DNF and you know, propositional logic. And we're talking about unwashed masses who are using these Boolean in the search engines. You say, you know, just give me a propositional logic formula. They'll say, yeah, I will go to Yahoo. Okay? Because they don't ask, you know, even high school education. Okay? So the question is, it's not clear that it's a good query language, but humans don't know. Normal humans don't seem to know how to express what they're looking for in this nice query language. Okay? And the same thing can be said, for example, for SQL. SQL is a great language to precisely express database queries. But if you don't know what SQL does, then you don't know how to convert what you're looking for into SQL. Okay, so there is that problem. So the big issue, of course, is ease of asking queries is, you know, just giving a list of keywords is easier instead of putting all these operations, Boolean operations and conjunctions and disjunctions. Okay? So what we'll look at, and we'll start looking at it, and I guess we'll continue next class, is documents as bags of words. Okay? So instead of thinking of them as sets of words, we made a huge jump on thinking of them as bags of words. Okay, what's the difference in bag and a set? Bag has frequency. What? Yeah, but more importantly, bag has frequency. The most important thing we care about here is bag has frequency. So I have a bag full of 4 oranges and 3 apples. You have a bag full of 10 oranges and 15 apples. Both of our sets are the same. You have bags, apples and oranges, I have apples and oranges. But our bags are completely different. Not completely, they're different. Okay? So you take frequency into account. That's the main important thing. Okay? And so here are a bunch of documents, and I'll you know, act as if sentences are documents. That's very short documents in a sense. Okay? So system and human system engineering, testing of EPS, a survey of user opinion of computer system response time, blah, blah, blah. And then here are the words, here are the documents, and the entry here tells you that this one tells you that there is zero occurrences of human in B. And you know, wait, oh yeah, there are 2 occurrences of system in A. So that's the kind of thing. Okay. Here is, let me show you one more example, because this unfortunately looks like a 0-1. I had to. Okay, here is a nicer example which we'll actually look at more in detail. Here are a couple of, it's 10 documents, okay? And the keywords that you are looking at, let's assume that either you can either think of them as the only words in the document, or that there are manual indexes done and these are the only keywords. And the keywords you're looking for are T1 to T6, database, SQL, index, regression, likelihood, linear. Okay? Now, D1 to D5 has, D1, for example, has 24 occurrences of the word database, 21 of SQL, 9 of index, and 0 of all the other 3 words. On the other extreme, here, D9 has 0 of the first 3 words, and 34, 27, 25 of T4, T5, T6. It's sort of actually easy to see that, to some extent, I mean, I can make an argument with you that these are documents about databases. These are documents about statistical data analysis. Because these guys are talking about regression, likelihood, linear. These are mostly talking about indices, database, and SQL. But it's not like database people cannot use the word regression even once in their paper. Okay? But they tend to use more of the database, and once in a while they'll say regression. Right? So it makes a difference. The frequency does make a difference. Okay? So that's your bag of each of these documents. And now once you have the bags, and the query can also be thought of as a bag. And so if I have a query, then it would be, so if I have a query, let's say database SQL, then it would be a bag. you know, it corresponds to a, sorry, it corresponds to a document. Now I know why I sound louder when I'm here, because it's live. So it corresponds to a document which, so if I am looking for a query T1, T2, which is database SQL, that's my document. So that's the query document. So I just write one more document called Q, okay, which has 1, 1 and the rest are 0. So in this model, if I say database SQL SQL, my query is different from saying database SQL. Okay? How many of you, without checking, think that in Google, if you use the word multiple times, you get different results versus using the word same one? So if you are looking for Bush, okay, you'll get a bunch of pages. If you say Bush, do you get different pages? Go check. Okay? But that similarity does actually assume that Bush query is different from Bush query. Okay, similarly, document Bush is different from the document Bush. Okay? Now, since we are talking about bags, let's look at the most obvious way of handling bags. Computing the similarity between two sets. If you are computing the similarity between two sets, there is a measure, there are many measures. One measure is called the Jaccard similarity. And what the Jaccard similarity does is the similarity between the two sets A and B is the cardinality of A intersection B divided by the cardinality of the A union B. This is for sets. But you can easily extend it to bags. Okay? So here is an example. So instead of taking, so now the, in the case of intersection, you define intersection over bags in terms of min operation and union over bags in terms of max operation. To make it clear, let's look at this example. If I have two bags, bag A has 5 oranges and 8 apples, and bag B has 3 oranges and 12 apples, then A intersection B is 3 oranges and 8 apples. Because 5 and 3 oranges at least, and 8 apples and 12 apples, so 8 apples at least. So the bag now, the A intersection B bag has 3 oranges and 8 apples, so it has 11 thingies, 11 fruits. And the A union B has 5 oranges and 12 apples. Okay? And so it's 3 plus 8 divided by 5 plus 12, which is 11 by 17, which is the similarity between the two bags. Okay? This does have the correct expectation you have, that if you give the similarity between the bag and itself would be 1 according to this measure. The similarity between a bag and a bag that doesn't have anything in common with this bag will be 0. And what nice is, it also gives you numbers in between. So you start off taking similarity from 0, 1 to partial numbers. So if I just apply Jaccard similarity metric here, this is what would happen. So if I'm, remember that if I can, retrieval is like basically computing similarity between the query document and the document, and then ordering them in the order of similarity. Okay? So in this particular case, I'll just act as if, I can talk about the similarity between D1 and D2 directly, and the similarity between D1 and D2 would be 0.57 by just our definition. Okay? So you can apply Jaccard similarity. It's like the first idea that you should try. You know, it's a very easy idea, and you can get by in many times. And you can improve Jaccard similarity with some of the other ideas we'll talk about later on, which involve, for example, normalizing the weights of the keywords. So, you know, you can normalize the frequency of the keywords such that you know, between, let's say, 0 and 1. And similarly, you can also normalize the commonness of a keyword. If a keyword is appearing in every document, then somehow its overall use is very little. So that's the inverse document frequency. So we have these two ideas called term frequency and inverse document frequency that we'll talk about next class. But that idea can also be used here to improve Jaccard similarity further. Okay. But we won't be sticking just to Jaccard similarity, and part of the reason we won't be sticking to it I wish I had it here, is that, what do you think, this by the way is the most important question you should always ask yourself for every ranking method. What if you're trying to compute the similarity between D1 and the concatenation of D1 with itself? Okay? Basically, what if I have a query Q and then I have made a ranking. Now I just went ahead and changed some documents such that I just artificially made them double their old size by just repeating the text. So the bag becomes bigger. Do you think the relevance should change? Do you think your similarity should change? To the extent you don't think similarity should change, you better make sure that your ranking algorithm does not change the similarity. Does Jaccard similarity change? Yes. Unless you normalize the bags, it would change. So one important idea, it's almost less important. One of the things we'll find out, and I'm sorry, I'm going to take one more minute and you get to go. One of the things we'll find out is, it really doesn't matter which similarity metric you use. Okay? It matters that you are consistent, that you use the same similarity metric all the time, and B, more importantly, it has certain reasonable properties, such as if the document, you know, it better not be the case that the relevance of the document is based on how long the document is. Okay? So if you do this crazy thing of concatenating the document to itself and just make it a bigger document, it shouldn't become more relevant. If it wasn't relevant to begin with, it shouldn't become suddenly more relevant. And so you should make sure that the similarity metric that you are using does have that property. So one important idea is normalization. Okay, so you, before you even start computing the similarity, you make sure that all documents, whichever representation you are using for them, if you are using them as a vector, you make sure that the vectors are unit vectors. If you are using them as bags, you should sort of make sure that the bags are in some sense sort of a unit bag representation. It's much easier to do it for vectors because you know what, how to do a vector to be unit vector. You divide it by the magnitude. But that's an important thing that we have to do to make vector similarity, the Jaccard similarity, be a reasonable idea. It's not really a bad idea, even though we'll talk more and more about the vector similarity rest of the time. Often you see approaches, even now, which use Jaccard similarity. Okay? We'll stop here. Next time, we'll essentially talk about the vector similarity, which is a straightforward extension, and then two extra ideas, term frequency, document frequency, and then also talk about relevant feedback, for which I might send you a reading.